I'd like now to welcome Sandy Ault. She is the author of the new mystery, Wild Sorrow, which is another in her Wild Mystery series. And she's on her way to Santa Fe now. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, welcome to you too for having me on.
It's great to have you back. Is this the third in your Wild Mystery series?
It's the third one.
And so the reason it's called Wild is probably for a number of metaphorical reasons, but also because the name of your heroine is Jamaica Wild.
That's correct.
And she is a BLM employee who gets herself into more scrapes in one book than most of us get into in 100 lifetimes.
True.
So the latest one starts with a hate crime, or an apparent hate crime, in which a woman who has been the matron at an Indian boarding school, which is now all boarded up, these books all take place in northern New Mexico, is found not only murdered, but murdered in a pretty gruesome way.
Yeah, her body's been desecrated.
And she has a sign around her neck that says, "I am not an Indian."
Mm-hmm.
And so that leads, and of course Jamaica Wild, fate being what it is, stumbles upon her body with her horse and her wolf, and the plot goes on from there.
It does. It starts out in this terrific snowstorm, you know, one of those kind that blow up over Taos, you know, and it has all these, you know, sort of winter elements to it. It takes place over the Christmas holidays.
And so how did you get interested in the whole subject of Indian boarding schools and the horrific things that happened there? How did you decide to incorporate it into your book?
Well, two things happened. One is I came upon an abandoned Indian boarding school one time on a research trip. And another is that I had a Pueblo family member. You know, I have been adopted by a Pueblo family who just sort of spilled the fact that he was a boarding school survivor. And as I began to ask around, I started hearing stories much the same way that Jamaica does in the book. And, you know, I was sort of appalled. It was a chapter in our country's history that I was just kind of mildly aware of, but I became acutely aware of after I talked to many Puebloans who had been in the boarding schools.
The stories that you tell, and they come out one by one during the course of the book, and of course people tend to confide in Jamaica Wild, the heroine of the book, and she hears things that are so gruesome that I, the reader, found myself hoping that the murderer was never caught and that that this woman deserved everything she got.
You know, Jamaica has a moment like that too when the body is identified and the FBI tells her who it was. And she's been to this school and witnessed some of the sorrows that have seeped into the walls and seen photographs of how the children were treated. And this is before she's even heard the stories. And she has this moment where she feels very conflicted. She almost wants to rejoice at this woman's death.
And that, it does lead one down a whole thought process of when is revenge justified, and if you don't do revenge, what else are you going to do? It
right.
really leads one into thinking about those questions, which don't really have any good answers.
Right, and there's a sort of a surprise twist at the end of the book, too, which relieves you of having to have all the answers to that.
Yes, which we're not even going to get close to
right.
revealing here.
That's
here
a promise.
And now. So you live or lived in northern New Mexico, is that right?
Right. I lived in Taos and taught at UNM Taos. I taught writing there for a couple of years.
And so how did you come up with and develop this BLM character? Do you have connections into that whole agency and that kind of work?
Well, I actually worked with them on the Cerro Grande wildfire, the one at Los Alamos, with the BLM a little bit. But I also have, I do a lot of research, so I have people that I know there. But it just occurred to me, a lot of the land around there is BLM land, and it's really wild. It's not developed. There aren't, you know, paved parking lots and restrooms and gift shops. And I thought that would be a pretty cool setting for a resource protection agent to be a sleuth.
Now, can civilian, whatever, a mystery writer, just walk onto BLM land and poke around?
Yeah, BLM land is public land. It's all we own it. We own it as a country.
Well, we own Los Alamos, too, but we're not allowed to go over there.
That's true. That's a good point. But, yeah, the purpose of the Bureau of Land Management is just to manage the land. They don't keep people off of it.
And there's a lot of wildlife there. And one of the things that I like about your books is that there are always other animals besides human beings walking around your books. In this case, there is a mountain lion who's very hungry, and two little wounded mountain lion mother and two little cubs.
How did you like the mountain lion in the book?
Well, I felt kind of bad for the poor thing.
Yeah. I think it became clear to me as I was writing the book that the mountain lion was not only a mountain lion, but probably a symbol for Native America, you know, the vanishing West.
Yeah, exactly.
How fragile and endangered and feeling crowded out of its natural habitat it is, you know.
Which is an interesting thing for you to say as an author, because it sort of reveals that you don't necessarily put in symbols on purpose. They kind of emerge and become symbols, or you recognize them as such after you've written them.
Yeah, this story in particular, I mean, this story kind of wrestled up from my subconscious, and it came right out of my heart. I mean, after I had heard so many stories from the Puebloans about the boarding school, this story just really began to emerge. And I've told a few friends of mine, I felt like with this one, I really managed to get out of the way and let the story tell itself.
I have to say, as I was reading it, I thought, this is one of those authors who gets better and better every book. It really, not that the other ones weren't good, but this had a kind of life to it on multiple levels that I really enjoyed.
Oh, thank you so much. What a wonderful thing to say.
Another thing that you have in the book is all sorts of glimpses into Pueblo culture, but as you say at the very beginning, there are also things that you don't give away. How do you walk that line between what you reveal and what you don't?
Well, sometimes better than other. I have made a few people angry at me from time to time, and oddly enough, they're not the Puebloans. They're people who want to know more about the Puebloans. But, you know, I've been told pretty clearly what I can tell and what I can't tell. I mean, that's told to me when I get to witness things or be a part of things.
And so, hang on, who's getting angry at you?
It just seems like there have been a few people who have been, you know, when I write that disclaimer that I've had to change or mix up rituals or even invent some parts, there have been a few people who've been a little indignant that I just don't tell the straight truth, you know.
Uh-huh.
But people would suffer if I did, and sacred trust would be violated. So I can't and I won't.
One thing that you do tell, and there's little bits of it that come out here and there, are things about linguistic and just cultural differences in how you should and shouldn't talk to people within Pueblo culture. And one of the things that really struck me in this book was that in Tiwa, if this is true, I don't know if you made this up or not, but it says in Tiwa, there's not a direct word for no.
That's absolutely true.
That's extraordinary.
Absolutely true. There is no word for no, and so they have these wonderful social customs like not asking questions so you won't be put on the spot to have to say no. And, you know, having things more gently insinuated or ways around saying no, you know.
So what do toddlers do when they, in English, are always saying no?
Well, you know, unfortunately, we're seeing this oral culture sort of get diluted and maybe even dissipated a little bit, because it's vital that the young people speak English in order to function in the greater society, and I mean greater in the as larger.
Right.
And so, quite often they aren't taught Tiwa or they don't practice it enough, and so toddlers do say no in English, but they can't say it in Tiwa because there's no word for it.
And so do they behave differently?
I think they do, and I think they're treated differently. I think they're indulged, you know, really a lot as toddlers and coddled and you know, their little tantrums and so on are tolerated in loving ways and because there's no word for no.
So the other part of it was that there's no questions. So you can't say to anybody, or it's considered rude to say to anybody, what's your name? Why did you say that? What do you mean?
That's
all
correct.
The questions that a sleuth in a mystery novel sort of wants and needs to ask.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true also. I mean, it's considered rude to ask direct questions. There, you know, you can say, isn't that a pretty sunset? You know, that's a question you can say, but
right.
What is your name is considered rude. But Jamaica finds ways around it. Like when she's talking to the elder named Seven Guns, she says, I would like to know your name.
Right.
And then he has the option of even, you know, either saying it or not saying it. So that's considered polite. You know, you give him the option.
We're talking to Sandy Ault about her new mystery novel, Wild Sorrow. There's also, as is necessary in, I think, a lot of your books, a curandera. So when things get really tough, the Jamaica Wild can go and get some help from somebody who always seems to know exactly what she's going through, even though she never sees her.
Right. And Tecolote is quite a character. You know, she sort of informs me what's going to happen for her part in each book.
How do you mean?
Well, all of my characters do, really. I mean, you know, they sort of have a life of their own, and I get cues from them, you know, as I sort of open up to them and allow them onto the page.
So what was your writing process like for this book? I mean, as you said, the book, you kind of got out of its way and let it be written, but you did a whole lot of research first. Did you then sit down in a very concentrated way and write the book?
You know, I love that question, Mary Charlotte. You always ask the best questions. I research as if I was writing nonfiction so that I can be as credible as I possibly can. And even if it's not in the story, my knowledge about it is there behind the story. And I know what I'm talking about. And I think that, you know, if I'm successful, that comes through in the writing. But the process for this one was hugely emotionally cathartic because I had to let the stories I'd heard and the things I'd learned and the studying I'd done, I had to let that come through. And I think the book is aptly named, Wild Sorrow. I mean, I think people should get their tissues ready.
Well, really, it's true. I mean, there's one character in it who's an alcoholic, and I found myself, after hearing his story, thinking, hell, I'd be an alcoholic too if I hadn't jumped off the Rio Grande Bridge.
Yeah.
And if I had lived his life.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think if we're lucky and the cards fall right and the stars are all aligned right, then also this will make people a little more aware and a little more compassionate. And if it opens their hearts, then they'll grow and their hearts will feel good and it'll ultimately have a good feeling. It's not just a sad story. It's a heart-growing story.
Yes, very much so. I was also thinking, I mean, this story of Indian boarding schools is one that I, in my capacity as host of this show, have heard in different ways. There are movies in the Santa Fe Film Festival that address the subject. There are books and essays and different people talking. And so, to me, I think, oh, I've heard this story before. And then I think, probably many of your readers don't even know that there is such a thing as Indian boarding schools. And I was just thinking about that information gap between people who know something and have heard it 100 times and people who've never heard the subject at all. And writing this mystery is, I would think, really a way of reaching a whole new audience for this subject.
It is. I mean, I really didn't set out with the purpose of, you know, sort of educating or informing people, but I like that there is a factual basis to some of the things in the story, the elements. I think it gives the story credibility beyond just good storytelling. But also, I mean, I guess I have a sort of sober mission with this Wild Mystery series. I mean, so much of this country doesn't realize that we have living Native American culture here. And I'm hurrying to capture as much as I can of it before it vanishes. And that's just, you know, me being a sleuth. I want to know as much about it as I can. And a lot of people write to me, you know, via my website from New Jersey and Virginia and South Carolina, and they, you know, they are really excited to know that there are living Pueblo cultures here. We all know that, you know, in New Mexico and in the Southwest, but people on the East Coast and the Upper Midwest may not.
And so it's, I was going to ask you, do you know if you have readers in those areas? Clearly you do.
Yeah, I do. I definitely do.
How do you get your books out to the audience that reads them?
The publisher pretty much takes care of that. I mean, I generally tour the Southwest and California, which I consider to be almost a nation of its own. But you know, my books are distributed not only nationally, but internationally.
Have they been translated yet?
No, I haven't sold foreign rights yet. I still have foreign rights. But they are in Australia and, you know, any English-speaking nation, or people can order them in English from any nation. And definitely they're kind of a big hit right now in Great Britain.
Very interesting. The another theme is the attitudes that people have, and this is something that we, again, talk about on this program, the attitudes that people have toward wolves, especially people who are raising sheep or cattle. The heroine, Jamaica Wild, has a wolf who is a major character in all of these books, and one of her neighbors is not too fond of it.
Uh-huh. And he's a rancher, just like Ken Salazar, I might add. The rancher and Ken Salazar came out this week when he delisted gray wolves.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Our new Secretary of the Interior. I was so disappointed in that Colorado one.
Very. I did not hear that piece of news. So
but he's a rancher. I mean, he's right. A rancher, and the attitudes of many ranchers are that wolves need to be killed. Let me say, I live right on the doorstep of Rocky Mountain National Park, and their idea of culling the herds of elk now is to hire sharpshooters to come in and kill a certain number, because there's no natural predators. Something's amiss here.
So you've got predators in the book, you've got the mountain lions, and you've got the wolves. You have a wolf, is that correct?
Well, one lives with me. That's a better way of putting it. And he, too, is a rescue. And, you know, T.Y. really lives with me because, A, he needed a rescue, but, B, I hope that every time he appears with me sometimes in events, and every time he's at an event, I hope it's an educational thing.
So people see, oh, this is a friendly animal that is at least partially domesticated and isn't going to destroy the universe.
Well, I don't know if they see him so much as friendly and partly domesticated as they just see that he's a magnificent animal with a real personality and, you know, some very understandable tendencies and instincts that make him worthwhile. You know, he gets to breathe some air, too.
In addition to everything else, the heroine is kind of, I don't know if you would call her a feminist hero or something like that, but she really can take more brutality than most men or women, and kind of roll with it and survive. She's a real survivor.
She's
tough.
In this book, I thought she got really tough. In this book, I knew a lot of things had to happen to her in order for her to be as embroiled and involved in this mystery as she needed to be. And you know, ultimately, the FBI handles hate crimes, and so in order for Jamaica to be invested in helping to solve the crime, it had to be, you know, a matter of life and death and needed to be critical to her. And so she really got tough in this book. She had it taken to her many times.
And she still rolls out of it, and her very appealing forest ranger boyfriend seems to be moving out of state.
Oh, you revealed that, you stinker.
Oh, sorry. seems to be is the operative word. I'm waiting for the next book because I find it a little hard to believe.
You know, actually, the next book is already done, and it's a prequel.
So people have to
wait till the next book.
Really? What are you? Can you tell us a hint about it?
Yeah, it's called Wild Penance, and it features the penitentes.
Very interesting. So when you say it's a prequel, does it take place before any of the other mysteries that we've read so far?
Yeah. In fact, the little preface in the beginning says that the Pueblo elders would say that this story takes place time before time.
Is Jamaica Wilde in it?
Yes. In fact, that's the first time she sort of meets all the characters except Roy. Roy is already there.
Well, we'll have to... when is that coming out? We'll have to wait for that.
Next year at this time.
I love it. You and Michael McGarrity are the two people who come on year after year, each year with a new mystery. We look forward to it, and we look forward to seeing you tonight at the Borders here in San Busco Plaza in Santa Fe, New Mexico at 7 o'clock in the evening, where you will be signing your new book. Sandy Ault is the author of the book Wild Sorrow. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I always love coming on. It's great to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you, too, and we hope to have you in the cafe next time.
You bet.
We're going to take a little break right now, and Linda Siegel will be with us in just a moment. Please stay tuned to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.